Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. During the workshop, you will hear from our panel of expert speakers. We will allow time for questions and comments following the presentation. Instructions will be given at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star, then zero on your touchtone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Senior Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Oh, thank you so much, Bella. And I, too, would like to welcome everyone to this program today. We're doing this in partnership with the Bladder Cancer Advocacy Network and Cancer Connect Education Workshop for caregivers' practical tips to cope with a loved one's bladder cancer. And this is part two of Living with Bladder Cancer. And today's program is supported by Pfizer, and I really want to thank them for their support of this program. Now, I just want to let you know about participants on today's program. We have over 126 participants on the program today, and you come from all over the United States, from both urban, rural, suburban, and frontier communities. And we also have a number of international participants from Egypt, India, Nigeria, Philippines, South Africa, Uganda, and the United Kingdom. So it's truly a global call, and it's a credit to each of you that you've chosen to spend the next hour with us to learn more about caregiving for a loved one with bladder cancer. And now it is my pleasure to introduce our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Yue Jiang, and Dr. Jiang is genitourinary medical oncology, the University of Texas, MD Anderson Cancer Center. And Ms. Jiang will be addressing updates on bladder cancer, the important role of a caregiver in communicating with the healthcare team, and helping to manage your loved one's treatment, including adherence and follow-up care. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Ms. Jiang.
Hi, thank you, Dr. Messner, for that warm introduction, and good afternoon or good evening or good morning, everyone. Thank you for having me today. So like Dr. Messner said, I am Yue Jiang, and I am a physician assistant at MD Anderson Cancer Center Genitourinary Medical Oncology. So my goal today is to provide you with a roadmap of bladder cancer journey so you know what to anticipate as you and your loved ones go on this journey together. So first, I'm going to give you an overview of the treatment approaches based on the stage of the disease, and then I will talk a little bit about the common types of systemic treatment and their side effects and how to manage them. And lastly, I will give you a little tips that hopefully can help you as you work with your treatment teams. And note that this is plural teams because you will very likely have multiple teams working with you. So first, I will start with localized bladder cancer. So this means that there's no metastasis, which means there's no cancer disease outside of the bladder. Everything is contained inside the bladder. And under this umbrella, there are two branches that we can go into. The first one is non-muscle invasive bladder cancer, and we'll talk about the muscle invasive bladder cancer later. So for the non-muscle invasive bladder cancer, the urologist or the surgeon would be taking the lead in this process. So they may do a transurethral resection of bladder tumor, or TURBT. Sometimes we call it TURBT. So this is just a surgery that takes out the tumor directly from the bladder. Sometimes in the process, they may also introduce chemotherapy or immunotherapy inside the bladder, and we call it intravesical treatment. After those treatments, if everything looks good and everything seems to be completely resected and removed, you would go on active surveillance. So that means there's no active treatment, and they will just check on you and see you periodically and do imaging, Sometimes they do urine cytology to look for any cancer cells in the urine. They may also do cystoscopy, cystoscopy, to basically stick a camera inside the bladder to look for any abnormalities in there. If there is any recurrence, and the recurrence is still local, still inside the bladder, sometimes this may require cystectomy, which means removing the bladder, and I'll talk more about that later. So in this process, because the surgeons will be taking the lead, it's very important to communicate anything new or unusual with the surgical team. There may be some peri-op infections, so this can happen with fever or pain or bleeding with the urination. Sometimes without infection, patients may still experience lower urinary tract symptoms, or LUTS for short. Symptoms may involve urgency of the urination, frequency, weak stream, incontinence, or hesitancy. And those symptoms can be managed with medications. You just need to let the team know. Now, with muscle-invasive bladder cancer that's still localized within the bladder, the surgery is still an important consideration, and radiation may also play a role. But this is when sometimes the medical oncology team, like the team that I am in, will also be enlisted to help with what's called neoadjuvant systemic treatment. So this would be the systemic treatment through pills or IV drugs that happens before any consolidation with surgery or radiation. So for the surgery, this is usually called the radical cystectomy to remove the bladder completely and then create a urine diversion. So when this happens, it is a major life event. But I would say most people, after some learning and getting used to, they can still live a normal life with high quality. You can still shower, exercise, even swim, even with a pouch on your belly. But as you get used to it, it's very important to stay close communication with the surgery. Sometimes the radiation oncology team would also take the lead. When we collaborate with them with radiation, and we will add on some low-dose chemotherapy to make the radiation work better. And I will also talk a little bit about the side effects of radiation later. Now, if you do have metastasis of the disease, which means the cancer is going outside of the bladder, it may be in the lymph nodes, it may be in a different organ. Sometimes it can happen in the bones as well. So when this happens, we take a multidisciplinary approach, which means the surgeons, radiation oncologists, and medical oncology team, we all work together to help you. And when this happens, the medical oncology team is usually the leading team, and we will be managing the systemic treatment. So there are different types of systemic treatment that may be used. Traditionally, we would use cytotoxic chemotherapy. So this is the chemotherapy in the most conventional sense that you may have seen on TV. And those are usually going through the IV, and sometimes they may require a couple days in the hospital. We may also use immunotherapy. And so far, the ones that we use are all through the IV. Occasionally, we would also use targeted therapy, and these can be either IV or oral drugs. And I will talk about individual ones later. We also have surgeons, radiation oncologists, and interventional radiologists involved to help with local treatment if the metastases are pretty isolated. So for example, we may do radiation to a small nodule in the lung or in the bones to kind of just zap it out. And sometimes we also ask for the help of interventional radiologists to help ablate a lesion, for example, in the lung or in the liver. Surgery can also be helpful as well, but my impression is that radiation and ablation are more often used in this scenario. Before you start any systemic treatment, it's important for you to let your team know about any other health conditions. Specifically, make sure that they are aware of any cardiovascular disease, such as hypertension, or any history of a heart attack or heart failure. If you are going to be using immunotherapy, then it's also very important to let them know about any autoimmune disease that you may have, such as rheumatological arthritis, inflammatory bowel disease, or psoriasis. If you have any neurological conditions, such as peripheral neuropathy, or hearing loss, or tinnitus, like ringing in the ears, you also should let your team know, because some of the chemotherapy and targeted therapy can make it worse. If you have diabetes, it's important to make sure that the team is aware of it, just in case that they want to get endocrine involved to help control the diabetes, especially if you have any complications, such as issues with your nerves or your eyes. Okay, so we'll talk a little bit about the treatment side effects. So we'll start with the cytotoxic chemotherapy. So again, this is the chemotherapy in the most conventional sense. So the way they work is that they try to find any cells that are rapidly dividing, such as the cancer cells, and they attack those cells. Unfortunately, some of the other healthy and useful cells are also in this category. So things like your hair follicle, your skin cells, or your blood cells may also be affected by the cytotoxic chemotherapy. Your team will be monitoring your labs to make sure that you are not in severe anemia, or if your platelets or the white cell counts are too low. So when that happens, we often would arrange for any transfusion, for example, or growth factor to boost your white cells to help you manage any risks during this process. And on your part, you can make sure that you eat a balanced and nutritious diet. We encourage people to stay physically active as much as they can tolerate it. We want to prevent any falls in case there's any bleeding risk. And it's important to just have some normal precautions for infections, like washing your hands, stay away from sick people, avoid large crowded gatherings. We also check labs to make sure that you are not having any renal toxicity, so issues with your kidneys. We may see increased creatinine in your labs. And on your part, if you see any dark urine, or if you feel like you are not peeing as much, or if you notice any swelling in your body or in your feet, that could be a sign of renal toxicity, and you need to let your team know that these symptoms are happening. Often, this is related to hydration as well. So if it's mild, drinking more water can help reducing the symptoms. But if it's really severe, so like a sudden sharp increase of your creatinine level, we would arrange for IV hydration. In the meantime, we advise people to avoid any renal toxic agents, such as ibuprofen or aspirin, unless you really need them. Liver toxicity can also happen, and this is often seen as increased liver enzymes, and we call those transaminitis, transaminitis. So this is just when your liver is getting insulted, and they're just secreting more enzymes. So we advise people to avoid alcohol during the treatment. You may also want to avoid acetaminophen, so this is Tylenol, and also avoid any herbal supplements, and also fatty, greasy food to protect your liver. Cardiac toxicity can also happen with certain chemo drugs like doxorubicin. So doxorubicin. And this can show up as shortness of breath, chest pain, or again, swelling in the feet. If this happens, make sure that your oncology team is aware. And sometimes we may get the cardiology team involved as well to help us manage the symptoms. Sometimes we can see electrolyte imbalance with cytotoxic chemotherapy. And again, we monitor the labs, and you can sometimes just take the over-the-counter supplements to help balance it out. Neuropathy can happen, especially if the treatment involves any platinum-based therapy, like cisplatin. So symptoms would be numbness, tingling in your hands or feet. Sometimes it's burning sensation in the hands or feet. Some people may have tinnitus or ringing in the ears. And when this happens, we may have to adjust the dose of your chemotherapy. Nausea, vomiting is quite common with chemotherapy, and we often prescribe antiemetics. So those are the anti-nausea medications. And they can be taken as needed if your symptoms are mild. But sometimes if it's really severe and affecting your appetite, you can take it as scheduled. We encourage people to eat small portions and frequent meals if the appetite is affected, and we often collaborate with nutritionists and dietitians. Diarrhea can also happen. When it happens, you need to drink lots of water to stay hydrated and also have some electrolytes in your beverages, but avoid sugar, as the sugar added sugar in the drinks can make the diarrhea worse. And let your team know, because we need to rule out any infection. If we know for sure that this is not infection, then we can guide you to take some oral antidiarrheal to manage the diarrhea. Fatigue can happen with basically any kind of treatment. And we encourage people to actually maintain their physical activity level, because if you stay in bed all day, that can actually make you more tired. Now we'll talk a little bit about the immunotherapy. So the two most common immunotherapy drugs are pembrolizumab, PEMBROLIZUMAB. And the other one is nivolumab, NIVOLUMAB. So the way immunotherapy works is that it trains your immune system to make them better at detecting and attacking cancer cells. And because of the way it works, the side effects are often associated with inflammation. So for example, you can have colitis, which is the inflammation of your GI tract. And it often shows up as a sudden onset of severe diarrhea, more than 5-6 times a day, watery, large volume. When this happens, again, we first need to rule out any acute infection. And then once we confirm that, we can help manage with, for example, steroids, or we can ask for the help of a GI specialist. On your part, again, make sure that you are drinking plenty of water and replenishing your electrolytes as well. Sometimes we may need to hold the treatment or just discontinue it altogether if it's very severe. Inflammation can also happen with the lining of your lungs, and this is called pneumonitis, PNEUMONITIS. And so if that happens, people may have coughing or shortness of breath. And we would probably order a pulmonary function test and also seek help from the pulmonology team. And again, inflammation, we often manage it with steroids. Rash can also happen with immunotherapy. You can take just over-the-counter allergy pills, antihistamines, if it's mild. You can also use moisturizer to make sure that your skin barrier is intact. If it becomes severe, like painful, blisters, skin shedding, that's an emergency, and you need to go to the closest ER with a burn unit. We can also see thyroid disorder with the immunotherapy. And the pattern is usually at the beginning, a hyperthyroidism, which means that your thyroid is working really hard. But then after that, it will burn out and you will enter the hypothyroidism phase. We monitor the labs for that, but people may also experience changes in their energy level, their mood, or their blood pressure. And so when you usually we don't do much for the hyperthyroidism phase unless there's really, you know, the heart rate is really fast. And then we may try to manage that and hold the treatment for a dose. But after that, once you enter the hypothyroidism phase, we often prescribe levothyroxine to help supplement your thyroid function. Okay, now we'll talk a little bit about the targeted therapy. The first one is called enfortumab vedotin, or EV for short. So it's enfortumab and vedotin. So this is an antibody drug conjugate, which means that this drug has two arms in their molecules. The one arm will find the target on the cancer cells, and then the other arm will deliver a dose of chemotherapy directly into the cancer cells. And unfortunately, the target that it's looking for is also found on the skin and also in your conjunctiva, in your eyes. So people may experience skin reactions, so it can be severe rash in the skin folds. Again, it can present with blisters or even peeling off the skin. Sometimes we use topical steroids to help manage the mild cases. We often refer people to dermatology for specialized care, and sometimes we may reduce the dose of the treatment or just hold a dose. Dry eyes can also happen. So we advise people to start using preservative-free and artificial tears at the beginning of the treatment and just continue using it regularly. Neurotoxicity can also happen with EV. So this often happens with peripheral neuropathy, so like numbness, tingling, burning sensation in the fingers or toes. But sometimes people may also have motor neuropathy. So this often shows up as dropping things from your hands or falls. So when that happens, again, we will try to adjust the dose or just hold the treatment. The other targeted therapy is an FGFR inhibitor called erdafitinib. This is a pill-formed treatment, and side effects is also associated with the way the drug works, which is basically trying to prevent any new blood vessels from growing into the tumor to supply the tumor with more nutrition. So side effects would be you can have diarrhea, constipation with the GI symptoms, but usually not as severe as the immunotherapy. So again, if infection is ruled out, you can take some antidiarrheal like Imodium. Stool softener can also be helpful. We also advise people to have a diet that's rich in dietary fiber and also naturally occurring probiotics. So like Greek yogurt is good. Kimchi and sauerkraut are also good, but you just need to watch out for the salt intake from these. It can increase your blood pressure. So we ask people to monitor their blood pressure closely at least twice a day. And when it becomes really high, significantly higher than normal, let us know. And we often work very closely with the cardiology team to manage the blood pressure as well. skin toxicity in this case is called hand-foot syndrome. So that's usually dry skin, redness of the skin, or a little peeling of the skin in the palms or the soles. And we encourage people to use fragrance-free lotion or cream when they start this drug. And any creams that has urea in it can also be helpful. Mucositis can also happen with this family of drugs. So that's the inflammation of the mucus, usually in your mouth. So people may have sensitivity to spicy food or hot food. So you can have, you can use some salt and soda to make a mouthwash at home, or you can ask for a prescription of mouthwash that has lidocaine in it to help manage the sensitivity and the pain. If you are doing radiation, the side effects are, you know, in the skin, there can be some skin irritation. So that's similar to sunburns. And so moisturizing and soothing non-irritating lotion or moisturizer is often very helpful. And some people may have bladder spasm if the radiation is to the bladder directly. There are medications that can help manage the symptoms. You just need to closely communicate with your radiation team. Now, a word about the complementary and alternative treatment, because as you go on this journey of bladder cancer treatment, you may receive a lot of advice or suggestions, and very often with the best intentions. However, I just want to make sure you know that it's okay to do your own research, and it's only natural that you want to find your own answer. But also discuss what you find with your treatment team, so they're aware of what, you know, like what has been suggested to you, and they can review with you together to kind of filter out what might be helpful and what may be harmful. In general, what we want to make sure that we're avoiding any drug interactions with the other medications or supplements, and we want to avoid any additional toxicity because the cancer treatments themselves already have some toxicity, and we don't want to add anything on top of that. And the other thing is sometimes those treatments, like the complementary and the alternative treatments, can be pretty expensive. And so you may want to focus your time and the resources on the treatment that we know can help, and we also are familiar with their toxicity profile. So just, you know, just make sure that you talk with your team before you start anything outside of the treatment plan. Some tips on when to contact your provider. So if you, during the treatment, experience any new or worsening symptoms, such as increased blood pressure. So for our team, we make sure that the goal is 140 over 90. So if your blood pressure, the top number, is consistently higher than 140, or if the lower number is consistently above 90, you need to let your team know. Rash, swelling, any unexpected falls, mouth sores, ulcers, or diarrhea, those are also reasons to make sure that your treatment team is aware. And some ER precautions. So when do you need to go to the nearest ER? So here are a few. If you have uncontrolled pain anywhere, either in the bladder or outside, if you have unstoppable bleeding in the urine or stool or just a skin cut and it doesn't stop bleeding for hours and hours, then you need to go to the ER to stop the bleeding. If you have severe headache, the worst headache you've ever had, and then you also have nausea or your vision is changing, go to the ER. If you have chest pain and you have a hard time breathing, also need to go. If you notice that your legs are swelling up, and one side is much bigger than the other side, there may be a clot. Then you need to go to the ER to rule that out. If you have a fever that doesn't go away, Especially if you are undergoing the conventional cytotoxic chemotherapy, this could be neutropenic fever, and sometimes it requires ICU admission. If your skin is falling off, then this is also a severe toxicity that you need to go to the ER for, and make sure that they have a burn unit that can manage this kind of skin toxicity. If you have severe diarrhea nonstop, especially if you see any blood in the diarrhea, then go to the ER. Dehydration, so if you notice that your skin is looking dry, or your cheeks are sunburned, these could be signs too of dehydration and need IV hydration. Now, as caregivers, you are the main advocates for your loved ones. So, of course, maintain close communication with your care teams, and save the phone numbers of the clinic and after-hour numbers. If the physician or any of the team members give you their direct phone numbers, make sure you save those as well. They may call you outside of the expected times. So they may call you on a day when you don't have an appointment. So just be prepared for that. And also, if you notice any changes in the health status or the symptoms, report that to your care team. And make sure that you monitor for any possible side effects and communicate that with your care teams. You can keep a calendar of the appointments so you don't miss any. If you have difficulty with the online, the messaging system, make sure that they are aware of it so they can call you directly to make sure you are informed. And it's very important to stay organized, so you need to know the treatment beginning and the ending dates of each treatment, any medications you are taking, and how you are responding to those medications. And last but not least, make sure that you are taking care of yourself. You could be the pillar for your loved ones in this journey. So you need to make sure that you are also well. Now with that, this concludes my part of the presentation.
Oh, well, thank you so much, Ms. Young. That was just a superb presentation. Very, very comprehensive. I know there were questions to you during the Q&A, but you've really covered this in enormous detail. I want to thank you so much for this, and I'm sure our participants do as well, so thank you. And our next speaker is Dr. Guadalupe Palos. Dr. Palos is both a doctor of public health, a master's in social work, and an RN. And she is former clinical protocol administration manager, Office of Cancer Survivorship, the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center, author and researcher in caregiving, health care disparities, and survivorship. And Dr. Palos will be addressing stresses, challenges, and rewards of caregiving, managing family, friends, partners, and traditions, long-distance caregivers, the increasing role of telehealth, telemedicine appointments. It is my great pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Palos.
Thank you, Dr. Messner, for the invitation to join this esteemed panel on caring for a loved one diagnosed with bladder cancer. And thanks to all of our callers for joining us in this call. Nearly everyone becomes a caregiver at some point in their life, and some individuals stay in this role over extended periods of time, often lasting months or even years. Caregivers are a valuable and essential resource in our healthcare system. Yet caregivers can often be underappreciated, overlooked, and somewhat invisible during patient-provider visits. So providing care for a family member is a challenging job that can be overwhelming, particularly if you still must work, maintain a household, care for other family members, or even have your own healthcare needs. Being a caregiver to a loved one with bladder cancer can be challenging, but with the right strategies and support, you can provide the essential assistance and care that they need. And one of our other speakers, Ms. Rios, will be talking a little bit more about the resources that are available through her network. Caregivers, of course, all of you that are caregivers on this phone know this very well, have multiple roles in caring for a loved one. For instance, caregivers provide the emotional support. They assist with medical tasks that often are complex or unfamiliar. They are often called to interact with multiple healthcare teams and providers and to coordinate the services from all different types of agencies, which can become very overwhelming and confusing in itself. And now what I'm finding out is healthcare is asking our caregivers to become more tech-savvy when working with medical equipment or even accessing information on electronic charts, or participating in televisit medicine. I'll say more on televisit medicine in a little bit later in this discussion. So as a result, caregivers can experience a range of stress-related symptoms, including emotional symptoms such as sadness, irritability, or hopelessness, physical symptoms, fatigue, but this is a different type of fatigue than you may have like after staying up all night with a sick child or running a marathon. This is a fatigue that never really gets better. It just kind of is your best friend always for a while. There's changes in appetite or sleep patterns, and you can find out that you're having or notice you're having frequent illnesses. There can be behavioral symptoms. Caregivers often withdraw from social activities. They can neglect their own personal responsibilities, that self-care, forgetting to go to their own visits, the dental visits, preventive care visits, et cetera. Or even at times, unfortunately, and there can be an increased use of alcohol or other substances to cope with all of these overwhelming activities. A growing body of research indicates that another stressor or challenge is the financial burden that families must deal with when the caregiver or the patient is the primary breadwinner. The economic impact of caregiving extends far beyond the out-of-pocket expenses. Many caregivers reduce their work hours, pass up promotions, or leave the workforce entirely, resulting in lost wages, reduced retirement plans, and diminished benefits like from Social Security. These career sacrifices can amount to hundreds of thousands of dollars in a lifetime earning losses. So it's all right to talk about financial burdens to your providers. And don't feel that you can be embarrassed or reluctant to share that. If your providers can give you the names of a social worker or a case manager, and they'll be able to help you deal with some of these financial burdens, as well as the other burdens that we just spoke about. So it's no surprise that such challenges significantly affect the caregiver's health and well-being. And these stressors altogether contribute to a syndrome or a condition known as caregiver burnout. Caregiver burden is a state of physical, emotional, and mental exhaustion that occurs when a caregiver don't get the help they need to try they try to do more than what they're able to. This condition can lead to serious health issues, including things such as the depression or the anxiety. So if you feel that you're experiencing any of these types of symptoms that I just briefly mentioned, be sure and talk to someone about it. It can be your faith counselor. It can be a healthcare professional, mental health care professional. It can be your physician. You know, those advanced providers that you have on the healthcare team, they're excellent folks to talk to and to share this information with. And again, never forget about your social worker or case manager. Yet, there's good news. Research studies also indicate that caregivers report their rewards for being a caregiver. Examples would include having a better understanding of cancer. Of course, in the being a caregiver, you kind of walk in the shoes of others that you've seen being caregivers. Caregivers have reported experiencing personal growth and role satisfaction, developing a closer relationship and interaction with others, establishing a greater appreciation of life, and increasing one's faith, happiness, and clarifying life's priorities. Now, these are things that rewards that the research indicates, but I've also heard it personally in the stories that my caregivers and their patients have shared with me. When caregivers neglect their own healthcare needs, though, there may be a sense of increased vulnerability. And these vulnerabilities become more apparent during the holidays. Special events can bring that brought joy before can now bring troubling experiences for caregivers, the patient, and their families. I'm sure that many of you on this call can recall during special moments when emotions, whether it be yours, the patient's, or the family's, were like a roller coaster wheel, that is, fluctuating between happiness and sadness. And you may be wondering how to manage the upcoming holidays. We have Labor Day right around the corner, and then after that, we have the harvest holidays and fairs. We have all of the holidays associated with Thanksgiving, and then also then with Christmas and all the New Year's, et cetera. So you may be wondering, how am I going to be able to manage all of these? And so in the following moments, I'll cover strategies to hopefully help manage the chaos associated with these occasions. So one helpful strategy that I have always suggested to caregivers and patients, and for myself even, develop a special occasion preparedness plan. This plan is like a hurricane preparation plan. And those of you that live around tornadoes and don't get hurricanes, you can also relate to some of this. You have to have a map that lists all the details of how to prepare for those special events. So here's a few examples that are related to cancer caregivers during the holidays. You can create new traditions, even if you cannot be there in person for those activities. Some of those you can start developing new traditions for you, your loved ones, and your family. So you can start that by being flexible about traditions and customs associated with the holidays or family gatherings. So if your home was the hub of such activities and you were the hostess, they say with the mostest, and you had all the best cookies and cakes and food, et cetera, it might be time now to make changes. For example, you can ask another family member to host the event. Now, this can apply even if you're the patient or the caregiver. Trying to do all of these and juggle all of the balls that go along with the planning such an event, a family event like this, is also going to put stress on you on top of all the other responsibilities that you may have. If travel is difficult, have a family project of preparing picture albums or video reels of past holidays, and you can share those with your loved ones and those that are living in other cities that you previously would have joined for the holidays. This can also be a great time to take advantage of channels such as Zoom or FaceTime, so you can actually be present at an event. When travel is possible, give your entire healthcare team notice that you'll be traveling, for how long and in what region. Is it going to be domestic or international? This is very important to keep that line of communication open, because you never know what's going to happen when you're traveling in other cities, in other states, or even in other countries. If you do decide to fly, keep your medications in a small carry-on bag with all the medicine. You may choose to keep them in the prescription containers or their original bottles. It might be a good idea to have a letter from your physician or your pharmacist stating that you are taking these medications because of blah, 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 blah. Because sometimes you're not just taking the medications for the treatment of your disease, but also, as we heard our previous speaker say, you can have the diabetes, you can have the hypertension, you can have arthritis, you can have all the other conditions that also require medication. You need to be vigilant about your medication. Make sure to keep a schedule of when the refills are due, because this will also help in minimizing the risk of being in another state or country and running out of medication. If you have pets that will not be traveling with you, remember to schedule or make boarding plans ahead of time. Boarding requests dramatically increase during holidays, and you want to make sure that your pet is well taken care of. So that will be one less worry that you have while you're out traveling or trying to enjoy yourself. Now I'd like to say a few words about long-distance caregiving. Long-distance caregiving introduces additional challenges. Who is a long-distance caregiver? It's a family or friend living an hour or more away from your loved one who needs care. When you don't live close by, it takes more effort to find out what's happening and to stay updated with your loved one's needs. There's no doubt about that. You can introduce those additional challenges. So that means that those challenges can be addressed with careful planning and organizing. So here's a few strategies that may help some of you long-distance caregivers. Create a list of significant phone numbers and email address, and share that document, whether it be a hard copy written out or whether it be an electronic form. Share it with friends or and family members who live close to your loved ones, so that way they'll have access to that information if anything happens. And remember to update it regularly. With permission, you can now even attend a person's telehealth visits. Telehealth visits are remote appointments, remember, with healthcare providers, and are often done by video conferencing. So this is an excellent way to get involved in the care and in keeping updated on what's going on with your loved one. Stay in regular contact with your loved one by phone or email. I can't say how important this is. Many times, patients or even caregivers feel isolated, especially if they don't live close to each other. So regular contact is an opportunity to bring up questions or needs. It's also give a loved one and their caregiver peace of mind. One way to obtain that peace of mind is through the telehealth medicine appointment. I spoke briefly about it, but I want to talk a little bit more about it. A major change in the delivery of healthcare is related to the use of telehealth and telemedicine. Now, these are two different types of online cancer care services. Telehealth refers to the whole digital world of programs that are like educational programs that are provided online, etc. Telemedicine is the delivery of care via a remote experience with a provider. Because this is a relatively new way of communicating with health care providers, many patients lack the experience of participating in the virtual visits. There also may be a lack of understanding or knowledge of how to use these tools. Today, there are several organizations that offer free workshops on how to use the computer for telemedicine. In fact, there are even workshops that focus on introducing seniors on the use of computers. For example, ARP has some, but also some of your local community organizations may have some of those. But here are a few tips to prepare for your appointment. First, be sure and pick your tool, your tech tool of choice, right? It can be your smartphone, it can be a tablet, a laptop, but just make sure that you know which one you're going to use and have it readily available. If there's batteries needed, check those batteries. If there's electrical plugs needed, get those electrical plugs close to where you're going to be sitting. And also, the most important key thing to all of this is to have a reliable internet connection. When you set up your appointment, make sure that you ask the physician's office or the clinic about any technology setup that may need to occur ahead of time. This can include downloading an app, or even sometimes you have to create a new account so you can access that app. You should also ask for a contact number in case there's a problem during your televisit. Be sure and choose a quiet, private place so you can hear your provider when they speak to you and they in turn can hear you. So reduce those distractions and interruptions, and that will make your appointments more productive. Have an update on your medical history, because that information will help your provider have important information to give you the best care that's possible. If they send you paperwork, prepare that paperwork before your call. This can include things like just including an update on your medication list, or updates on your insurance information, updates on payment information, things of that nature. Sometimes providers ask their patients to take vital signs such as weight, blood pressure, or temperature, so it's helpful to obtain those vital signs prior to your appointment. You can also take pictures of any visible changes such as rashes or things of that nature that can be seen. Take a picture of it, you could upload it, so that way you don't have to take the time of showing it to the physician while you're online. These photos will be helpful as your doctor evaluates you during the telemedicine visit. And I can't stress this enough, and I'm sure you've heard it over and over again, but I'll repeat it. Write down your questions ahead of time. if when you're on a telemedicine call and perhaps it's the new one for you or you're getting new information, it can be very distracting. And so those wonderful questions that you had in your mind suddenly fly out the window and you can't remember one of them. So write them down so you'll be able to have them readily available. At the conclusion of the visit, review your treatment plan, repeat it with your provider, so that way you'll know what's needed. And also ask about when to schedule a follow-up visit. And just one thing, and I think we heard our previous speakers mention this, keep tabs on your own physical and mental health, you as the caregiver. Cancer caregiving can be an isolating experience, which contributes, again, as I mentioned, to that caregiver burden. Don't ignore signs such as interrupted sleep, fatigue, anger, frustration. These are red flags, just like a temperature of 104 degrees or a blood pressure of 180 or over 100. You know you need to seek action of some type and seek medical care when these happen. So that's the same thing that happens when you see these emotional or physical needs occurring in yourself. Because if these symptoms are ignored for a long period of time, it can severely impact the caregiver's ability to assist their loved one. So finally, remember to maintain a balance. Plan ahead and prepare for the caregiver's, excuse me, the patient's visits, and be prepared to take care of your own. Thank you for allowing me to share these thoughts with you. Dr. Messner, turn the program back to you.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Palos. That was just an extremely wonderful presentation, very comprehensive as well, and just lots of information. I'm sure there'll be questions for you during the Q&A as well. Thank you so much. And our next speaker is Patricia Rios. Ms. Rios is Senior Education and Advocacy Manager, Bladder Cancer Advocacy Network, and she'll be discussing the Bladder Cancer Advocacy Network BCAN Free National Programs and Services and give you information about their website. It's now my pleasure to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Ms. Rios.
Thank you for the introduction, Dr. Messner, and to Cancer Care for putting on this important program. I am excited to talk about the free education and support resources we have for patients and caregivers. For those who are not familiar with BCAN, we are a community united in support of people impacted by bladder cancer. We aim to provide educational and support services, from information about clinical trials available in your community, to webinars, printed materials, a designated podcast, to a treatment matrix. You can find these and much more on our website at bcan.org. For anyone looking to speak to someone who has gone through a similar bladder cancer experience, our peer-to-peer program called Survivor to Survivor matches bladder cancer patients and caregivers with trained volunteers who can share insight about their own experience with bladder cancer. And for our caregivers listening today, I encourage you to download a copy of our easy-to-read Bladder Cancer Basics Handbook for Caregivers. Again, available on our website at bcan.org. We also have an in-person summit twice a year that brings together patients and caregivers across the spectrum of the bladder cancer journey, providing an opportunity to see old friends and make new ones while learning from experts in the field. Our next summit will be held in Columbus, Ohio on October 17th and 18th. Information about the summit is available on our website, again, at bcan.org. I will conclude by sharing that in 2023, BCAN partnered with Cancer Care to launch a toll-free support line for bladder cancer patients and caregivers. The support line is staffed by oncology, bilingual social workers from Cancer Care, who can provide emotional and practical support, as well as help find the various resources I listed today. The support line can be accessed by calling 833-275-4222. Again, it's staffed Monday through Thursday between 10 a.m. and 6 p.m. Eastern Time, and Fridays between 10 a.m. and 5 p.m. Eastern Time. And the number again is 833-275-4222. And with that, I will turn the mic back over to Dr. Messner.
Well, thank you so much, Ms. Rios. Wonderful organization, really go-to for all of our participants. Thank you so much for that excellent, superb presentation. Please take advantage of all of their wonderful resources. And our next speaker is McNicky Malafitis. She's an oncology social worker with our New Jersey program she's a New Jersey program coordinator at Cancer Care, and she'll be discussing remembering to take care of yourself, self-care, and stress management tips, and she'll also give you Cancer Care's free national, she'll describe Cancer Care's free national programs and services and our Hopeline and website. It's now my pleasure to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Ms. Malafitis.
Thank you, Dr. Messner, for having me, and thank you, everyone, for being here today. As mentioned, I'll be discussing the topics of remembering to take care of yourself and self-care and stress management tips. Just to start off saying that these are all easier said than done, but they can go a long way when caring for a loved one. So just remembering to take care of yourself, trying to be mindful of our nutrition. So nutrition doesn't only impact our physical well-being, but also our emotional well-being as well. And then also including and maintaining our sleep hygiene. So maybe incorporating a sleep schedule. It can really play a role in remembering to take care of you. Even if you're not able to fall asleep right away, just trying to set a nightly routine or structure for yourself. And then also keeping up with your own personal health care. As caregivers, we're always making sure our loved ones are, you know, maintaining their appointments and medications, but also keeping an eye on yourself. Attend your yearly checkups, keep up to date with any medication management. It's important to also care for yourself while caring for someone else. And then with remembering to take care of yourself, also comes self-care and stress management tips. So these will look different for each person, but just some of them that may be helpful. So for starters, utilizing small goal setting. So be kind to yourself. If you can't do it all, give yourself 5 minutes for one thing, and remembering that you're important in this as well. Also with small goal setting, setting boundaries for yourself. You know, it's okay to say yes, but it's also okay to say no. It's also okay to ask for help. There are a lot of individuals who are willing to provide support, whether it's an ear to listen, a hug, a person to mow the lawn, grocery shop. You know, feel free to utilize them for that assistance. Also utilizing the medical team. Yes, are they specific to your loved one's care? Definitely, but they're also a resource for you, whether it's the hospital social worker, nurse navigator, patient advocate. They could just be a really great additional support. Attending educational workshops, so just like you're doing today, trying to build that knowledge for yourself. Exploring caregiver support platforms, whether that means a support group or My Cancer Circle, so different organizations that might offer this. Incorporating physical activity, anything that allows you to move your body. It can really help release emotions and help us feel more grounded, whether it's walking, stretching, dancing, yoga, anything to move your body. And then the last few, meditation and mindfulness. It's not for everybody, you know, but at some point, sometimes it can help us just for 5 minutes to remind ourselves to breathe. Maybe we identify the five senses to bring ourselves back to our grounded state. And then engaging in something that brings you joy, whether that's journaling, listening to music, reading. And then lastly, there are different emotional supports that are available. There's counseling, support groups, peer matching. There's also the option of respite care, which is short term, but it's relief for those who are caring for family members who might need more assistance in order for them to care for themselves. And then lastly, to wrap it all up, just to talk a little bit about our cancer care services. So we do offer limited financial assistance, oftentimes for individuals who are in active treatment. We have some online support groups, some coping circle workshops, which are usually virtual. We offer some community programs along with our educational workshops, similar to this one today. We have some resource navigation, where a navigator may be able to assist with additional resources. Some counseling services for those residing in New York or New Jersey. At times, we offer short-term counseling. We have something called My Trialist, which is where our special programs team can assist with clinical trials. And then we also have our Cancer Out Loud podcast, which is a podcast where individuals are able to share their story and their narrative. If wanting to look more into that or contact one of our Hopeline specialists or oncology social workers, the direct line is 1-800-813-4673. And then our website is cancercare.org. thank you so much, everyone, for being here today, and I'll return it back to you, Dr. Messner.
Well, thank you so much, Ms. Mizitis, and I actually want to, this is a wonderful presentation, and I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A as well. And now we're going to move right on to the Q&A, and I'm going to ask Bella to explain to all of you how to queue up, how to queue up and ask an online question. Bella?
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. At this time, we will take questions from the web only. You may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question.
So, it's a question for Dr. Palos. I want to be there for my mother, but I found that asking her something like let me know if you need anything hasn't been useful since she started to act more isolated. I don't want to overstep, but I want to help her. So what are some better ways that I can try to see what she needs? Ms. Malfitas, could you address that question?
Hello?
I can definitely address. Oh.
Is Dr. Palos here or Ms. Malfitas?
Yes, no, I'm still here. I was answering the question.
Oh, great. Oh, thanks. Okay,
yes,
thanks.
Okay. So one of the first things to do is to kind of determine what's the best way to be diplomatic. But what the issue is that this is your mom, and your mom has always been the one kind of guiding everything. So now it's your turn to do that guiding. You know, you mentioned that about overstepping. It's okay to overstep. It's the delivery of how you do the overstepping. I have the same issue with my family members. My 90-year-old mom, she's always fine. I don't have the problems. It's okay. So I have to figure out other ways to ask her these questions, you know. And so you can say, hey, I was having problems with this. I don't know if you've ever had that. What do you think? Something of that nature, so where you're not asking the direct question, but you're going around the back door, so to speak. It's very touchy, especially if a parent is so used to being an independent person and has never really had to rely on their own children. So it's a reversal that they, you know, it's difficult to handle, not only for the parent, but also for the adult child having to do that. But be diplomatic. Try to remember how you can be going in through the back door. And it's always hard when you ask a direct question. So try to ask the questions in a different way, and that may be helpful. And good luck, because it's hard. I know it's very challenging to get that type of a feedback when you ask someone, do they need help? Thank you.
Thank you so much. And for Ms. Malfitas, do you have any advice for caregivers who feel like they don't have much of a choice? My dad doesn't have anyone else to take care of him, so it feels like I can't say no.
That's a great question and a really tough situation. It's more so of having that conversation, kind of similar to the discussion we just had, just that healthy communication, you know, having that conversation with dad or loved one, whoever it may be, about how it is impacting you, and saying that maybe you just need 5 minutes to go outside and get fresh air, or, you know, maybe you just need to call somebody for a few minutes. You're in the home with him, knowing that you're there with them, but needing that moment to just call somebody. I would also recommend accessing the additional supports, whether it's counseling, support groups, or, you know, connecting with the hospital social worker to see what other resources are available. Because although we may not be able to leave our loved one's side because we're that primary caregiver, maybe we can step away for a few minutes.
Excellent. Thank you. And I'm going to ask our speakers to provide takeaways. I'm going to start with Dr. Zhang, if you'd like to take away just a minute takeaway from today's program.
Of course. Yeah, thank you for having me today and allowing me to share the information with everyone. So I just want to remind everyone that the cancer treatment is very individualized. And so you can be very open about your goals, preferences, and your concerns with your clinical team so they can customize the treatment and your care for you. And treating bladder cancer is a team sport. So if you have a large team, you want to keep a list of your physicians, especially if your team members are from different institutions or facilities. And it's also a good idea to keep a journal of any symptoms and changes, so you can also always refer back and see what happened when certain medications came on board. And last but not least, know that you and your loved ones have a life outside of cancer. So you have the power to ask for accommodations. If life happens, like if you have a holiday or wedding coming up, you can ask for any schedule changes or even those changes to make sure that you're still enjoying those events.
Oh, excellent. Thank you so much. Thank you. And Dr. Palos.
Well, being a caregiver, there's no doubt, is incredibly draining. So no matter how much drive you have or how much you want to stay strong and keep on going, it's exhausting. But just remember to keep believing in yourself, keep trusting the work you're doing, that you're doing is not in vain, and be sure and reach out to others for help. You've heard some of our other speakers mention that. Can't stress this enough. It is not a time to be by yourself and to deal with everything by oneself. Ask for help. And good luck to all of you in this really incredible journey that you have. Thank you.
Lovely. Thank you so much, Dr. Palos. And Ms. Rios.
Yes, thank you for the opportunity to provide some closing thoughts. My message to the caregivers listening today is that you're not alone. There's, as you heard today and reinforced by many of the speakers and by the resources shared by all of us, there are many resources available to support you through this journey. So suffering in silence should not be an option. Again, we have several resources on the Beacon website as well through Cancer Care and even through your provider office or in your own community. Take that first step in asking for help and you know, I want to reinforce what someone said of taking that time to take care of yourself as well is very important so you can take care of others.
Thank you so much. Thank you. And Beacon is a wonderful resource for all of our participants and is the call center with Cancer Care. It's wonderful. Thank you. Thank you so much. And Ms. Malfitis.
Yes, my message to the caregivers today is caregiving looks different for each individual. So remind yourself to be kind to yourself, utilize self-compassion, and just always remember that you can't pour from an empty cup, but you are doing your best.
Excellent. Well, I just want to thank all of our speakers. You've really been phenomenal, and our participants have been phenomenal. And although we've done this program before, I have to say that the participant questions and the speakers really work so well together. This is probably the best program we've done for caregivers. Practical tips to cope with a loved one's bladder cancer. Also, I do want to make a few comments before we close the program today. As you've learned, both the Bladder Cancer Advocacy Network and Cancer Care offer a host of services. And the Bladder Cancer Advocacy Network is clearly the go-to organization, the only organization in the country that has the resources that it has for people with bladder cancer. So please do call them. And I will be sending, you'll be getting a SurveyMonkey evaluation in about 10 days after the program. And in that evaluation, you will find the phone numbers for both Cancer Care and BCAN and their websites and any other information that we feel you would be really important for you to have that our speakers addressed. Also, we've also learned that from our participants that that during the day, usually you're able to reach your healthcare team, but evenings, weekends, and holidays are always a problem. So please always check that you have your physicians' phone numbers, weekends, evenings, and holidays. It's very important. Also, I just want to reiterate, you are not alone. There are a lot of organizations out there to help you with Bladder Cancer Advocacy Network and Cancer Care at your side. Again, I want to thank you all for your participation today, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop, and you may now disconnect. Everyone, have a great day.